Tonight's State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around. Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate,
Garden State Debate.
Everyone, and welcome to Garden State Debate. My name's Ryan, and we have another very special episode today. Actually, a panel of co-hosts, you can say, that fortunate to have joined me today to sit down and talk to Dustin Rasiopi of the Bergen Record, who's our special guest today. So before we get into that, just want to introduce our co-hosts. Len Resto, who is a councilman in Chatham Borough, and also we have Joe Colangelo with us, who is a small business entrepreneur, amongst many other things. But I'll let them give themselves a little bit more of an introduction, and then we'll get into Dustin and his background, and look forward to that discussion as well. So, thanks for joining us, Len. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm good. Just had my coffee, so I'm ready to go. Anything else you want to add on your background?
No, I just would add that, you know, I'm happily retired after spending 42 years in the insurance industry. I'm president of the New Jersey Association of Railroad Passengers, which is why I'm so involved in transit issues. And I'm a councilman in Chatham Borough, and that and $5 will get you a Starbucks Frappuccino.
There you go. Pretty important guy.
And I'm also the answer to a trivia question.
Oh, yeah?
Is named the only elected official in the United States who is an openly gay Puerto Rican, elected both as a Republican and a Democrat.
Wow.
Very obscure.
Has anyone ever asked the trivia question, though?
No, but I'm hoping Joe, when he does his trivia contest, will ask the question so I can get it and win.
Okay, well, I'll get it. We'll all get it, too, since we know the answer now. Thanks again for joining us. Joe, good morning. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. It's a great Saturday morning. Thanks for having me on as a co-host. Excited to talk with Dustin and all of you. Started Boxcar in 2016 as a way to help people park close to NJ transit stations. And so we partnered with property owners like churches that don't need their parking. And through an app that we developed, we rent it out to commuters. We also run bus service into Manhattan from a number of towns in New Jersey. It's really a New Jersey focused company. We've expanded to 6 other states, but the vast majority of our business comes from, helping these New Jersey commuters, have a better daily commute, add certainty and reliability to their commute. Obviously, the pandemic has affected us greatly because, nothing's been more affected by commuting than commuting, right? Where the airlines look great compared to anybody in the commuting business. So, being down 99% allowed us to try out new things. We helped people get groceries. We basically redirected food from the supply chain to restaurants, schools, airlines, and cruise ships right to consumer supply chain, right? By taking these boxes from produce shops. We started running drive-in movies. We were the first ones in New Jersey to do that. We had them announced within 12 hours of the governor's permission. It finally gave us the ability to do drive-in movies. We ran 50 of those over the summer. We have now time to schedule your visit with Santa. So for $20, you can have a certain COVID-friendly Santa visit for you and your kids. And, we're trying it all out. Like, the goal is to get to the other side of the pandemic and continue focusing on transit. But, it has not been easy. And looking forward to talking to Dustin about, my goal here is to learn what is going on in the state house, because from the outside, it just seems like there's no rhyme or reason. The rules change when Governor Murphy gets caught breaking them, or, when he wakes up feeling good or bad that morning. And so, I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Dustin.
Great. Thanks, Joe. And that's an excellent background and more detail that you gave, and the whole story of pivoting your business towards serving people in need during the pandemic is a whole, probably another podcast in itself. So thanks again for joining. And to Dustin, you know, I think a lot of folks around New Jersey has gotten to know Dustin through the countless governor briefings that he's been at. We'll have to ask him if he's counted how many. But he's I think many would say he's the guy that's asking a lot of the challenging questions when he's at those briefings for, you know, the Bergen Record and their readers and things like that. But Dustin has also followed the State House in Trenton very closely during the pandemic in terms of his investigative reporting from the onset and all the way through today. And there's a whole other background too that hopefully we can get into in terms of how, where did Dustin start in his career and where was he before we're lucky to have him here in New Jersey keeping us updated on the governor and what's going on, especially through the pandemic and now. So with that, I'd like to welcome you, Dustin. Thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So you're probably tired from talking a lot through some of the stuff that I just said and being at these meetings all day. So maybe you can start by just giving us a little background on yourself in terms of, like, where did it all start? I think people usually that tune into this broadcast find it interesting to hear kind of, you know, the what drove people into their current position. I think it'd be helpful to hear a little bit about maybe even starting from college or early on in your career and then how you got to Jersey.
Right. Well, I'm from New Jersey, but I took a pretty unconventional path toward getting here. I went into the Navy. I went shortly after 9/11, and I spent 5 years in the Navy, and I was a mechanic on a submarine, which was not exactly the best fit for me. I'm not a very handy guy, but I made it through, and I decided once I got out, I should go to some sort of schooling. Otherwise, I was going to be stuck being a mechanic for the rest of my life, and I didn't want to do that. Not that being a mechanic's a bad thing, but it just wasn't good for me. So I was enrolled in community college in Connecticut and was not sure what I was going to do in life. I was, 24 or so. So I was hitting that point where you have to start making decisions about your future. And luckily I was enrolled in a journalism class and I just kind of got struck by the whole thing. I was doing these assignments and I was really enjoying it. And the professor was an editor at the local newspaper. And I had just taken such a shine to it. And he had noticed that. And he offered me some freelance assignments. And to me, it was just like the greatest thing in the world. I had this just free rein to go and explore and do things and then write about it. And then I would get paid a little bit of money. And it had never occurred to me before that there was something that I could do. And so I ran with it, and I was able to, after a couple of months, I got offered a job at that paper, and then off I went. I've been doing it ever since, and that was in 2007. And then about a year later, I took a job at the Vail Daily in Colorado. So I was working in a ski town for a little while. But as many people know, the newspaper industry has been just hemorrhaging jobs since then. So I got in at kind of the wrong time. I got laid off. And so that forced me to pack my bags and come back home to New Jersey. And then I freelanced for a little while, actually a while, like 2 years. And then I landed at the Asbury Park Press. And over the last couple of years that I was there, I started working in Trenton. So basically the second Christie term is when I started in Trenton in the State House. And from there, I jumped over to the Record. And so I've been at the Record since 2014. So yeah, a little over 6 years now.
One question I've always had about the Asbury Park Press is why is that like such a big newspaper in New Jersey? How has that maintained, you know, been successful when so many other ones local have failed? Like, is there something special about the region? They have like a great editor, or am I just kind of misunderstanding what the APP is?
Dustin was there.
Yes, it was because of me. The whole industry is in such bad shape. Nobody is really succeeding. I mean, we're just doing enough to get by, really. But there are bigger papers and institutions that have been able to kind of patch it together, for lack of a better term. I mean, we're just not swimming in money, but we're getting by. And the Asbury Park Press, Star Ledger, the Bergen Record, those are the three big ones that come to mind. Asbury Park Press and the Record were all owned by Gannett now. So Gannett has this, has a pretty broad reach across the country and in New Jersey, the Courier Post, the Herald News, a whole bunch of others, Daily Record.
Yeah.
So, you know, being owned by a big corporation that owns USA Today helps a little bit.
Ups and downs, yeah.
Yeah, and the pandemic, like many businesses, really, really hurt. I mean, all of us company-wide had to go on furloughs, which is just a euphemism for unpaid vacation for a couple of months. So, you know, it was really difficult to survive. And as you probably clearly know, and lots of other people know from their own experiences, it's been a shared sacrifice, to say the least.
No, that's a good point. How I think folks here, you know, the population of New Jersey relies on the media to help with democracy, and they have not been spared during the pandemic, and like you said, whittled down even to even more.
And that's a very good point, Ryan. You know, I'm 67, so I love the print papers, and I do follow the online. I have online subscriptions to the Record and to the New York Times, and I see, you know, news outlets going online and charging for it, which is, you know, a way to make money, because up to that point, you could go online and it was free, so you couldn't see how they were making money. But, you know, I just think that, and I'm sure Dustin would agree, that the type of work that he does is really important, because too many people are getting their news from Facebook or Twitter, which are not the most reliable sources.
Right, and especially in the pandemic, even just from people I know, or I'll hear from my wife, these different rumors that they're hearing and seeing on social media, and I have to knock them down. I don't know where it comes from. The cardinal sin of the newspaper industry obviously was not charging from the get-go when things went online. So now we're all playing catch up when people have become used to getting their information for free. And if you add on top of that, the increasing distrust of the media in no small part, thanks to the president, it's a bad combination that leaves us in a pretty perilous position, kind of trying to regain trust in a lot of ways and to convince people at the same time that they should pay, you know, a couple dollars a month or whatever it is for a subscription. So it's tough.
That's a great point, Dustin. Actually, it was one of the questions I was gonna ask, you know, with the president flat out saying that the press is the enemy of the state, do you find that true in New Jersey as well, or is it less a factor in New Jersey?
I think it's less of a factor in New Jersey, but that sort of rhetoric, it kind of seeps into the bloodstream of, you know, kind of the public consciousness. it's allowed, I've heard more people say the term fake news over the last 4 years than ever, and in the last year especially. And it's frustrating because it's not true. And that has, in a lot of people's eyes, you know, we've kind of been cheapened, and it's given people license to disregard us or to engage in conspiracy theories. And I just think that a lot of people really don't know how journalism works, even people in government. And so a lot of times we're really misrepresented and in some rare cases kind of characterized.
Yeah, and that's a good, you know, I mean, when I was going to school, you were always taught that the press was, quote, the fourth estate. They kept the other three branches of government honest, and they were to be respected. They may not like them, but they were respected. And, you know, what I've seen over the last 4 years especially is this total breakdown of respect for journalism, for reporters, as if they were the enemy and it's okay to assault them. I mean, it's just unheard of. It's horrible.
It is. And I'll be honest, there are times when I question my own personal safety if I'm out at a certain event, because as an example, there at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a march/protest from the State House down to the War Memorial where the governor gives his coronavirus briefings. And things were so on edge at that time. It was the beginning. Things were really bad. And you saw a lot of Trump flags, which is fine, but some of the people who were there, and it was a minority of people, they were really angry, understandably so, but a couple people were outfitted like they were in a militia. And, you know, that's an unsettling feeling when you have that combination of, there weren't guns, just to be clear, but, you know, people looking like they are paramilitary and this simmering anger, and the president who in different instances has incited violence, plus that rhetoric about fake news and enemy of the people and all that, you can't help but get that kind of creeping fear, like, could something happen here? Nothing's happened, obviously, but it's a really unsettling feeling at times.
No, that's a great point. And going back to the whole fourth piece of that Len was talking about in terms of the without media coverage, even locally at a local level, and how we talked about how it's changed over the years, it provides no oversight for the government that it's covering. So, you know, day to day, people that are in other jobs and other industries obviously rely on the media to do that type of work, and obviously it's been a struggle just in general, even probably pre-pandemic. And then, yeah. And then all of a sudden, it got basically, inflammatory in terms of what was expected from the media versus what you were able to do. So, would you agree that your workload stepped up from when the pandemic started? On the flip side, your compensation and what you got out of it from a monetary value, kind of, like you said, there was a furlough program going on and things like that. And that wasn't even specific to the record that was happening at most papers, from what I understand. So maybe you could kind of describe that for us, kind of as the pandemic started, and how you got, also maybe how you got tapped to be the guy from the record to join the coronavirus briefings.
Well, it was by default because I cover the governor. So it was this, yeah. You know, and that was an assignment that I had wanted going back to when Governor Christie was in office. And so when I had that opportunity, I wanted to grab at it because covering Christie was an experience like no other. But yeah, at the outset of the pandemic, I remember attending these briefings, which at that time were at the State Police Operations Center in Ewing. So we were all tucked into this small room, not knowing that we could have potentially been exposed to the virus and spreading it, because we had just gotten one case and then two cases, three cases. And there was just a certain vibe in the room, and nobody knew what was going on. Not even, you know, the health commissioner and the governor, who in that first week was in the hospital. And I'm not saying that they didn't know to denigrate them in any way. It was just such an unknown, we didn't know what we were facing. And there was just a weird vibe in the room. And I remember turning to one of my colleagues at Politico when the numbers were starting to get higher and higher. And, you know, I said, I guess it's kind of a silly comment, but I said something like, gee, I could see us getting up to like 10,000 cases someday soon. You know, and that just shows you how ignorant I was, because then it just spiraled out of control. My editor at the time started taking the briefings to allow myself and some of my colleagues to work on all the other stuff that was breaking. You would have these briefings and you'd be writing three or four stories off it because you had new restrictions, or there were just so many questions that we had that led us down to these rabbit holes of stories. But he wound up leaving, and then I started going day to day to the briefings. And that's really what I've been doing since, I guess, May. So we're talking dozens and dozens of briefings. You know, we've, as you alluded to, I and many others have become somewhat familiar names, maybe not faces, but for a lot of those people who have been tuning into the briefings religiously, which surprisingly has been a lot more people than I had anticipated.
A lot of people at home. They don't have much else to do.
Yeah. A lot of people at home. It's just so funny that even 9 months later, and this happened just the other day, where my wife will say to me, oh, so-and-so texted me and said, is that your Dustin who's at the briefings? Like, they're still learning that. This has been going on. I've been the guy there.
They tried to make you a news story at some point because you were doing your job, right? You want to talk about that?
I was a news story at one point, yes.
Of your own, did you write about yourself or what?
Because he was asking the governor the questions he was meant to be asking the governor. And I don't know how much he wants to get into it, but it was one of these things where I was just shocked that people were trying to make this a news story when he was the person out there asking the right questions.
Yeah, I won't get into too many details about it. People may be familiar with it, and if not, then they could just Google it. But I was the subject of a news story that was rife with inaccuracies. And as you said, I've been doing my job. I've been asking questions that I think are in the public interest. And anybody who disagrees with that, they can, but I would definitely challenge them on that and tell me where what I'm asking is not for hopefully the benefit of the general public and not for anything else.
Yeah, it was.
I would only add to that, you know, it's very interesting, and what I've learned being in government is that people always say, we want smaller government, we want government off our backs. But when something happens like a pandemic, they immediately turn to the government and want to know, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't you on top of this? Right. And, you know, I think people have to have a new mindset that it's not the size of government, it's the quality of government. You want good government, whether it's big or small, you want good government. And that's kind of been, you know, obviously totally missing on the national level. So it's been left to the 50 states and the U.S. territories and possessions to kind of map their own way. And in New Jersey, being a home rule state, it comes down to 565 municipalities kind of doing their own thing. So it's been just a very challenging time.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, it has, the pandemic has probably forced them to rethink how they consider the role of government, and that's whether you're Democrat or Republican or agnostic, whatever. And the issue of 565 towns and home rule and all that, that makes things even trickier. Most people probably don't even think about that at all, but that's where, you know, somebody like Governor Murphy runs into criticism and, you know, problems for himself, because this is a pretty unique state and you have, you know, almost 600 little fiefdoms that want to be left alone and run themselves. So it's a balancing act of how you're going to impose restrictions or leave it up to the towns or the school districts or the police departments. That's a very tricky balancing act. And I think that would be the case if Murphy was the governor, or Christie was the governor, or anybody else was the governor. Whoever is in that seat right now, it is a very hot seat, and there's no way that you're going to be able to please everybody, not even on, you know, on a regular basis, but in a pandemic, it's just such a tough job to have. So in that regard, I would have to give Murphy some credit, because, you know, you can't win. It's a lose-lose proposition no matter what.
That's a good point. And I hope we can get into some kind of some details about things that have gone on during the pandemic. Obviously, we cannot wait till it's over, and we can talk about it as history, but being that some of your best work and notable work has gone on during the pandemic in terms of journalism, that be some good subjects to pick your brain on. But before we get there, just like a couple more questions on being at the briefings. And you kind of alluded to it by saying, you know, your wife's friend asked, like, oh, is that your Dustin, and things like that. And I've even asked you in the past, like, you know, from the public sitting at home, all the spotlight is on the governor, and, you know, obviously a lot of it should be. And then they go to that questioning period, and he just kind of calls on first names and things. So you really don't even know who's asking the questions. And then, so that leaves the public to be like, where is this person from? You know, what media outlet, or is it even in New Jersey? I mean, do you think that, and then on top of that, I just, as a secondary question, the way that the questioning works, and how you ask your questions, you kind of get answers, and it appears to be based on a microphone. So if it's not in front of you, no one can hear you. So how does that work? How do you view that in terms of asking a few questions? And then do you feel like you need to rebuttal, and sometimes they're misinterpreted, or do you feel like you're given sufficient answers? I know, obviously, we hear a lot of sidestepping and things like that when some of those challenging questions come up. And I think people respect your approach, which is asking a lot of those challenging questions. So kind of maybe you can walk us through those dynamics of the format and the discourse with the governor through that. Which
the format benefits the governor more than it benefits us, because it's a kind of a bizarre tableau if you were actually to see it, because as you noted, there's him and the health commissioner and the superintendent of state police, they're all up there on the dais, and then in front of them, we're, you know, behind the cameras where nobody sees, is us, and we're all spread out at least 6 feet apart on these metal folding chairs. We have to wear masks. So we're kind of scattered throughout the war memorial. And he has one aide who carries around a microphone on a boom stand going to each reporter. And we ask our question, and then that person moves on. So it's very difficult, almost impossible, to ask a follow-up question unless you go and you literally grab the microphone from that person or you just shout out something, which I have not really done. I try to ask my questions as precisely as possible, and I try to maintain a modicum of decorum. I don't like shouting questions out and being too disruptive, but sometimes it's warranted, and you may hear that sometimes because, let's be honest, the governor sidesteps a lot of questions, especially the tough ones, and he has his answers to a lot of things that are scripted or rehearsed. And I'll give him credit. He doesn't deviate a lot. You can't, it's really hard to knock him off balance. And it's been challenging for me and frustrating because I'll leave a briefing sometimes and I'll be, you know, smacking myself in the forehead. Like, how did I ask that question wrong? How did he evade that question? And then there are times where a lot of people who tune into these frequently will hear, if he gets pressed on a question repeatedly and people are following up on it, he'll say, I've said enough. That's all I'm going to say about that. And that's it, because we don't have the microphone, so he can do that. So that's why it's beneficial to him. He gets his time in front of the camera. It's carried on, you know, places like News 12 and NJTV, and it's on YouTube. So you have a lot of people tuning in. They're getting that initial message that he wants so that they hear that narrative. And then when the questions come and things start to turn more critical or the pressure's turned up a little bit, then, you know, he gets to breeze right through. And you know, that's good for him, you know, tough for us. So in those ways, you know, this is really, it's been really good for him. And, you know, to his credit, he's been out there 2-3 in the heat of it, 5 days a week, giving updates to people on the critical information, the basic information that they need, which is a good thing. But certainly when it comes to really, you know, hardball questions and critical questions, I, for one, have been dissatisfied with a lot of the answers.
What are some of the hardest topics or types of questions? I don't know if anything sticks out going back from the beginning till now. What are some of the hardest subjects to actually get an answer out of? Is there anything in particular that sticks out in terms of things that that the governor avoids or does not answer that you've kind of learned through the process and maybe don't even ask about it anymore because you just know he's
yeah.
not
answering. Well, you know, the news breaks so frequently in the pandemic that, you know, what's really hot one week, the next week is you forget about it or other things take precedent. You know, one thing that sticks out in my mind, this was around May or so. It was an awkward, uncomfortable question for me to ask because I was just shocked by what I had heard. And this was coming from, you know, a couple different sources at the time, that the governor had never even had a one-on-one conversation with the health commissioner. And I had heard some conversations that she had with other people, really expressing frustration with the communications and how things were going. So to ask him that when he's sitting right there next to her, you know, why haven't you two talked and is this true? You know, it was a little uncomfortable, but that's what you need to ask the questions.
How do you answer that one?
Well, this is typical of what I was just talking about, how he has a way of skirting around. He didn't answer that question directly, as I remember, but he had said, well, we have the greatest health commissioner in the country. And
Yeah, I think I remember that. I don't know if it was like a tape that got released, or, you know, there was a couple of things during that period of time where information was kind of being leaked from, or reportedly leaked from the health department. And that was kind of one of those things. And I think you covered it both with your questioning and in your journalism.
You know, I think Dustin, though, hit the nail on the head. And I think, you know, both the governor and Governor Cuomo in New York, they call these briefings. They're not press conferences. And I think that's the difference. You know, you're briefing someone, you're giving information. You know, it's similar when New Jersey Transit hired its, quote, customer advocate who was going to have a briefing, and the advocates all refused to go because we weren't going to be allowed to ask questions, or whatever questions were asked, you know, they just had the ability to sidestep it. So I can commiserate.
It's really powerful to see, or surprising to see how powerful these briefings are to so many people, right? You look at like the ratings for Cuomo and Murphy, and like you would think that because they had the highest per capita deaths in their states, you know, in the whole country, their ratings would be low, right? But because they do these briefings, there are so many people out there, they're like, hey, like, I don't really care what the policy, maybe this is what they're thinking, like, I don't care what the policies are, I don't care whether they're helpful or hurtful, but by God, like, you know, it's like the major Trump supporters who are like, well, he fights, you know? And it's like, well, he briefs. That is the sense I get, is that if Trump had like put on a windbreaker and like stood next to charts like 5 days a week, he would have won the election with like 40 states, because there seems to be, when people are in fear, and it doesn't resonate with me, but like there seems to be, well, whew, someone is in charge. And you know, now that I learn more about the format from you, it's like, oh, of course, right? And so he gets a stand and say, I stood here for 6 hours and answered every single question the journalist asked. And it's like, well, that's true. First off, like, don't you have governing stuff to do? Like, you know, and then the second hand is like, you're not really answering the sort of combative questions or getting to the heart of these matters that matter to people. You're really just kind of, there's a direct correlation between acting like you're in charge and, you know, getting a sort of bounce in the polls from it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's worked out well for Governor Cuomo in New York. He won like an honorary Emmy or something like that.
He wrote a book and won an Emmy.
He wrote a book.
They're actors. Like, he did the best at it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think people, for the most part, they just want to find out what's going to get shut down next, or, you know, how whatever Murphy says that day is going to affect them. I'm not sure too many people give a whole lot of thought to some of the more nuanced aspects of what's going on and how government's working, or some of the probing questions that we may have. So it's really good for people like Cuomo and Murphy to be out there regularly, because like you said, people do want to see somebody's in charge. And we saw this happen, and I saw it up close with Governor Christie after Sandy, when he went around, he was touring the state in his blue fleece, and, you know, he had people crying on his shoulder. You know, people just ate that up. It's like, oh my
powerful.
God, he can be compassionate. And so you have this format with Murphy that works really well for him, because he comes out there, he gives you all the basic facts of where the virus is at. And then he goes into memorializing people. He chooses three people who've passed away from the virus. And so that personalizes it. And it's really effective for him, because he's giving information, he's compassionate. And then, like you said, he gets to, you know, take the questions from us and move on to the next thing. And in a lot of cases, he's going on MSNBC or CNN. He's getting a lot of national attention. And so you have this governor who was, you know, totally under the radar in his first year or two. Nobody really knew who he was. And now he may be more of a household name for a lot of people. So, and that's going to help him next year in his reelection. So in a lot of ways, politically, the pandemic has helped him in terms of being able to kind of shape an image, let people know who he is. Maybe, well, he's got really high approval ratings, so that bodes really well. So image-wise and politically, with all the awful things that the pandemic has wrought on us, it's benefited Murphy in those aspects.
Yeah, you know, Joe made a good point with businesses, and I'm sure, Dustin, you've seen that in the briefings. You really have on the economic side of this, because there's a lot of different things. There's the illness part of it, but there's also the economy. And it's two economies. It's I've never seen anything like this. So if you're a big company and you can work from home, the job is getting done, they're doing phenomenally well, the stock market's at record highs. If you have a 401k, you're doing great. But when you come to small businesses and mom and pops like we have here in Chatham, it's like the Great Depression. You know, they are struggling and they're looking to see, you know, what can the state provide me? What can the Fed provide me? Can the local government provide me anything? You know, and locally we're struggling with our budget. You know, we have a train station in town with an empty parking lot and there's 400 grand out the door that has to be made up somehow. So, you know, I'm sure you see that and a lot of that doesn't come out, and that's the tightrope that I think the governor has to work, is that, you know, you almost have to have two set of rules, it seems to be, big business versus small business. Small business is really hurting. And, you know, for restaurants, you can have no more than 10 people inside. And, you know, we're saying that's not going to help them. You can't dine outdoors now because it's too cold or it's too wet, et cetera. So they're relying on takeout. It's just, it's a tale of two economies. Sorry to ramble on, but I just...
Well, you're right, I think. And I think it gets back to what I was saying before about it being a lose-lose situation for the governor. I don't believe that he wants to hurt the economy, but he doesn't have a lot of great options, largely because there's no money. The money that we had is out the door. The EDA has given out good amount of money in grants, but it's never going to be enough to cover all these businesses in the state. And I hear it day in and day out. And I know it personally. I mean, my wife owns a small business and she is shut down at the moment. So, you know,
I mean, that's a good point. The
economic reality.
What about the $2 billion left in CARES funds, right? I mean, or is it $1.8 billion now, right? New Jersey got $2.2, $2.4 billion, and after like 4 or 5 months had not given out more than 10% of that, right? This is aid that was meant for businesses, aid that was meant for residents, and we are still sitting on this $1.8 billion that, you know, and Murphy's, you know, I guess the articles that I've been reading say that his goal is to repurpose that money for the state treasury. And hopefully in a Biden administration that becomes feasible and they rewrite the CARES Act. How do you square that with the fact that you're hoping that he doesn't want to hurt the economy and wants to help out small businesses?
Well, that's a tricky one because I really don't know exactly what's going on with that money, because you're talking about money being reserved for treasury. Sorry, I don't know what's going on there.
You're good.
You're talking about money being reserved for treasury and being converted in a Biden administration. That does not square with what the governor has been saying repeatedly, which is that the money has been earmarked and that there's been some difficulty and confusion around the rules federally on the CARES Act money, how it can be spent. So they're waiting on that for clarity to put that money out.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point by what you just said, what you're hearing, and also what Joe's saying, which is from the way that the CARES Act was set up, it was to give money to states, and that was to be distributed in pretty much immediately or over, you know, obviously,
which the other states have done,
you know, over a period of time to save out there. Yeah, to save small businesses and what Len was talking about, the businesses that are going under every day as we speak. And then you have him saying it's earmarked, but then you also have like our fiscal year extending and they're working out nuances with the government, which from what I hear is basically trying to expand the rules, going back to Joe's comment, of what they can do with that money. He wants to potentially keep that money and use it, you know, wider and into next year. But the way that it's written now is it needs to be spent by year end. So he has, you know, 20 days to spend it unless he is successful in those deliberations with the Fed. So yeah, whether it's earmarked or not, or, you know, if the White House or whatever federal regulation body does not approve this sort of extension or repurposing of whatever's left, then what are we going
to
do?
It's a very clever way to Dustin's earlier point. Like, he's very good at answering these questions, right? Like, we have other states that are like took their CARES Act and they just like gave it to their small businesses. And, you know, on average, 20% of small businesses close every year because, you know, small businesses are tough to keep alive. I think the average is up to like 25% this year in a recent report, and New Jersey's at 34%, right? So 34% of New Jersey small businesses have closed so far this year, which is actually not as crazy as it sounds because it's normally 20% because there's a high turnover. It's 25% on average nationally. But, you know, that the difference between 25 and 34% of small businesses closing, that might be $1.7 billion in CARES Act that has not been distributed, right? Like, that might get us...
And that's a good point, Joe. It's a good point, Joe. And to your point on the briefings being successful, if you ask the average person on the street about the CARES Act funding, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, we're waiting on Washington to give us more money. Every penny's been spent. It's not so.
No. And also to add on to the business perspective, it's not just businesses. It's people, right, at home that are out of work. So obviously our unemployment rate shot up to 15%. Joe, you might know what it's at now. I haven't looked recently, but there's people at home. You know, we have an eviction moratorium across the state for what, 8-9 months. And that's going to have to end soon.
So expires December 31st. I was just going to add, you know, here in Chatham, and Joe knows this because he helps us with it. And he actually was one of the brainchilds of it. We have a food drive. The Chatham Borough's median income is $164,000. And, you know, when I came up with the thought along with others that we'd have a food drive, people were like, oh, nobody's going to come. Chatham's an affluent community. We get 35 to 50 families coming through there every week. We've been doing it for 29 weeks, over half a year. And there are people in line who live in what I call the high rent district, the $2 million home districts, where the kids and the husband and wife all lost their jobs. They have a monster mortgage. They didn't really have great savings. They had paid for colleges, and they're in a food line. And that's what goes on. And, you know, so people are waiting for money. You know, the sweetener on unemployment was huge when that went away and got reduced from 600 to 300. But we're seeing more and more families, and it's going to increase over the winter, I am telling you, because, you know, this is just getting, it's, if we thought it was bad back in March and April, it's really getting bad now.
Yeah, that's what's scary about right now is we don't know what's around the corner, but we have a strong suspicion that it's going to be bad, and that we're going to be reliving the spring all over again in terms of people being sick, people dying, and the economic catastrophe that could be there. And that's, I guess, you know, this is what the governor has been hammering on, is there needs to be more help. Even if there's $2 billion sitting in a closet somewhere in the state treasury, you still need more money for what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 months. So
You just lose credibility when you don't spend that, right?
It's, I'm sorry?
I think we lose credibility when we raise our budget, increase our state budget, and don't spend the funds to help people out. It's just really tough to go back and say, like, hey, we really need more money. They're like, you know, we gave you these funds and you haven't used them, and zero people, cut zero costs. And like, I don't run a government. So I know there's a real human cost associated with firing people. I run a company. I took my company from one person in 2016 up to 9 full-time employees. And, you know, in August, after all the pivoting kind of ran out of steam, I had to lay them all off, right? Like the numbers have to add up somewhere. And so there are these business owners like your wife and like me all across the state that have had to do these horrible things. But it's like, to see that burden not shared, even in the slightest bit, by giving an average 4.5% raise to state employees, it's really disheartening. It's very hard to like take this this love that I have for this state and not feel like I'm getting completely ignored and seeing my taxes raised yet again, for a state that's not giving me the services that I'm paying for.
And you have a state agency, just to get to.
That's not your fault, Dustin.
Yeah. I mean, just to get to New Jersey Transit as an example, right? So they get over $1 billion in CARES Act funding to keep them going, and they're asking for more, but they can't tell you how they've spent the money they got. And meanwhile, small businesses can't get stuff. And, I tell people, any small town that has an empty business district because stores go under, mom and pop shops go under, is not a town people want to move to. And it starts a downward spiral. And that's true of Chatham, that's true of Cranford, that's true of any town.
And another point on that, Len, is the small businesses that are in the way I've read some articles, certain counties are getting CARES Act funding and others aren't. So like Chatham or Summit or certain seen as affluent areas are not getting CARES Act funding, but they don't realize that the business owners in those towns are not all from those towns.
Exactly.
They come from other places. They come from Newark. They come from, Elizabeth. They come from wherever. And so the mechanism of going back to just this whole kind of topic is I think one that's really hurting, you can tell, Main Street businesses. And you compare that to something like Home Depot. If you drive to Home Depot, you can't even get a parking spot. I mean,
yeah. And you look at Dustin's situation, right? His wife has a small business, which is shuttered at the moment. So they're relying on his income. That's a hard thing to do. And he's got a 2-year-old, it's got a family to support. I don't know.
So Dustin, are you going to bring these issues up for us?
Am I going to bring issues up? Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. You may have some questions to bring up next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just,
no, just kidding.
It's pretty frustrating. I moved to New Jersey. I feel in some way like I'm complaining, like the guy who bought a house right next to a baseball field and complains about the foul balls, right? Like I know when I moved here, I grew up in New Jersey. I was in California for 8 years. I did, a couple of years in the Navy as well. I moved back knowing that this isn't like the paradigm of fiscal responsibility and good governance, but all I'm asking, I guess, is like, just, do the backroom deals and get the money out, right? Like, yes, I know there's going to be a tax called grift and it's going to be paid with favors eventually. And so for every dollar that gets spent, maybe only 80 cents, gets back to the people. But like, my gosh, get those 80 cents to the people, right? Like take your, your graft tax out of it, but push it out because we really need it on this end.
Well, I think that just generally goes back to my point earlier about people rethinking about the role of government in their lives. And it's, for all the different sort of partisan divisions that we have in front of us these days, it seems like there's a lot of people who are in favor of big government because it's going to help them. And that's because they realize, we can't do it all on our own individually. We need some sort of safety net. And it is a I'm not trying to advocate one way or the other, but it's just interesting how so many, you know, fiscal conservatives slash, you know, classic Republicans who do want small government are seem to be in favor of, you know, big government spending and ringing up deficits, not necessarily in New Jersey, I mean, because, you know, we're really stretched pretty far on that.
I would not advocate for any more bailouts or funding here, but I would.
Yeah, no, our debt is way out of control, and that's you know, that's not necessarily on Murphy by himself, although he's contributing greatly to the debt, but that's going back many, many years, lots of different mistakes.
Yeah, that's been historically true in New Jersey. And, you know, if I've learned one thing as a locally elected official is that everything is local, right? So people in town, everything is the mayor and the council's fault, you know, and then you tell them, oh, that's a county thing, so you got to go to the freeholders. Oh, well, you guys are supposed to do that. No, that's a state issue, you know. They expect the local officials to do everything. And so I come back to my earlier point, which is it really doesn't matter the size of government, but you need good government. You need competent people that are doing things well. And if you don't have it, it breaks down. And I think that's what's happened on the federal level is that, you know, the incompetence is rife. And so it's been tossed to the states, some more competent than others. And it's just a mishmash on a pandemic that requires leadership, competence, and follow through. We don't have that.
And Dustin, kind of going back to the briefings, do you, you know, it's pretty much the same cast of characters for the most part on a day-to-day basis, which I think you mentioned earlier, being like the health commissioner, the governor, council, and the police chief, right? And then I believe certain special guests come on here and there, but do you think that it would be helpful to potentially mix that crowd up a little bit more in terms of having somebody on from government or a couple people to take these hard fiscal questions and have answers? Like, why isn't the treasurer at the meetings? I'm not, like, it's not your fault, but just kind of thinking out loud, is that something that you hear from like your readers and other folks based on this stuff? Yeah. Where's the treasurer, you know, or people that are involved in the economy from a government standpoint? And why aren't they at the meetings answering these questions? And we're dealing with what you described before, which was a really good balancing act that the governor does when these types of questions come up.
Well, he has had, I think, almost every cabinet member up there besides like agriculture. And I don't believe he's had the treasurer up there. I may be mistaken, but certainly she is not a regular presence there. And you know, when you're talking about some of the questions and confusion that you have about finances, you would think that she'd be a very good person to have on the panel. On the other hand, we've had a lot of these cabinet members and commissioners up there, and they haven't always had the answers that are full answers to some of these questions. I mean, it's something that I'm sure the governor has considered, but this format with the health commissioner and the superintendent of state police, that covers all the basics that they seem to want to put out there, the health data, enforcement, and then the governor, you know, doing his thing with whatever announcements he has.
Yeah.
I had a question for you, Dustin, that's really, it's transit but pandemic related at the same time. I know on the bus system, we still had restaurants closed. We still had gyms closed. We had barbershops closed. And the governor had been promoting social distancing on public transit. But then all of a sudden he reversed himself and said, you know, for buses, everybody can ride and just, you know, wear a mask. Were you surprised at that? kind of disparate dichotomy?
I've been surprised by a lot of the decisions he's made. There's been a lot of disparities. You can go through a lot of them. Although, you know, he's been consistent on a lot of different things, but especially earlier, there was these decisions being made that for me and, you know, other people, we were left scratching our heads. Like, you know, that's an example. And he may have a reason that I'm not aware of that he did that. But going back to what we were talking about with those uncomfortable questions about the governor not communicating with the health commissioner at a certain point in time. Around that same time, we were hearing from inside the administration that they're not, you know, they're making a lot of these decisions based on the front office's thinking, not necessarily on the science, as the governor has said. He has that slogan, data determines dates, but that's always been kind of a mystery because there's he hasn't detailed, and that's where frustration comes in on our side, because as reporters, everything is in the details, and we live in with details, and we weren't getting those. So, you know, it would be ideal if, for example, the governor came out and said, I am keeping restaurants and gyms closed based on this data that we're seeing. But on the flip side, we feel comfortable enough to run buses and you can wear masks and be okay because we have this data. That level of transparency, I think, would eliminate a lot of these questions that we have. And it would help the governor because he wouldn't be getting this blowback from advocates. He wouldn't be getting as many critical stories in the press, perhaps.
It's a theory on why he doesn't do that, as it boxes him in, right? Because then all of a sudden, keeping restaurants closed becomes more unpopular, but the data hasn't moved. And he's like, well, if you look at it from the outside, like, he's doing things that he thinks will be safe unless they're really unpopular, right? Because so far, closing a lot of these things early on was not necessarily unpopular. It was like everybody had to do their part. We were all in this together. So small business owners were like, hey, I don't mind closing my restaurant because it's in the public interest. And so that's my theory. I don't know. What do you think about why he doesn't say, well, this is the, data that we need to keep schools open and closed and businesses open and closed and dining open and closed.
Yeah. In addition to that, also, it seems that a lot of decision-making that he's done, Governor Murphy, has been in conjunction with Cuomo and Lamont and kind of the region. They've acted together. And he's even obviously touted that in different ways as it relates to a lot of things, but one of them being, for instance, that quarantine ban that they just got rid of that had basically every state on it except for the states that were doing actual quarantine. So they got rid of it a couple of weeks ago. But New York has, New York State, from what I understand, I have family and friends there, they have benchmarks and they have their regions separated. And when certain metrics hit and they have a color-coded scheme, then things close down. So if if Western New York hits a certain positivity rate with X amount of transmission, restaurants close indoors and barbershops close, and that actually happened. Meanwhile, New York City surprisingly doing very well. Obviously that odd decision with the schools happened that was reversed, but why do you think Governor Murphy has not followed Cuomo in that one particular case in terms of actually setting territories and then on top of that setting any sort of metrics around what's going to happen? Like, to your point, people are just tuning in to hear the latest decision of whatever he's going to say in terms of this is the new indoor dining capacity is X, but nobody knows in advance. And why do you think that is when they do have the data?
I can't say at this point why that is. Earlier in the pandemic, from what I was hearing from multiple people within the administration who had knowledge, was that the decisions were being made top down from the front office, and then the health department was being consulted on that or asked to back up the decisions. I don't know for certain if that's the case anymore. Maybe the governor wants to have a little bit of wiggle room, because if you look at Mayor de Blasio in New York, I mean, he's just had a disastrous couple of weeks in the public image because that 3% threshold for closing schools, they hit it, he closed the schools, and then he just got killed for it. So I'm sure Murphy doesn't want to be in that same sort of circumstance, and he needs to have a little bit of freedom. But it would, I think it would help for a lot of people. I've heard this consistently from business owners since probably May or so. They just want to, they want to have some sort of heads up. If we hit X number, will I be able to reopen, or will I be able to reopen at a certain capacity? And that way they can plan, they can tune into the briefing, get the numbers and say, okay, it looks like we're heading to a certain point. I can start preparing my business to reopen, or on the flip side, I can start preparing my business to shut. They want to have some comfort in knowing what's around the corner and not find out from a leaked story that today the governor is going to announce these new restrictions and they take effect tomorrow. And I think that really frustrates people.
We're in an absolute debacle of indoor dining, right? When it was on a Tuesday that he said, oh, by the way, we're not going to reopen indoor dining on a Thursday. One of my very good friends, owner of a bar, restaurant, family place, he had an employee who had left and during the pandemic and had a good job at IKEA, bartender. And he said, all right, we're getting, indoor dining reopens on whatever that was, June 22nd. I forget when the time of year that was. And he hired him off of IKEA. So this guy quit his job at IKEA, came back, got the bar ready to reopen. And, 2 days before it was, oh, indoor dining's not allowed anymore. And, my friend, this is a bartender who had been with him for years. He couldn't go back to IKEA. And so, what was his option? He then paid him $800 a week for whatever that was, 5, 6, 7 weeks. So there's another $5,000-$6,000 that he could never get back, right? That he just basically lit on fire because Murphy changed his mind 2 days before reopening indoor dining.
Well, what's happened is since the beginning of this through now, is we know a lot more today than we did back in the spring. And the one thing that we focused on was the transmission rate, right? So we were saying if it's one or less, that's good. And so when we hit one and it fell below one during the summer, people kind of let their guard down. But what you really needed to look at was the number of cases and the positivity rate, right? Because if I have it and I get Dustin sick, that's a positivity rate of one. If I have it and I get Joe and Dustin sick, it's a positivity rate of two. But let's say I'm 4,000 people and I get 4,000 people sick, right? That's a positivity rate of one. But now you have 8,000 people sick. And so now you got to really look at, like yesterday, there were over 5,000 new cases of COVID in New Jersey, and the positivity rate, I think, got up to very close to 15%. But people are still focused on the transmission rate. Yeah, but the transmission rate is 1.04. And that plays a lot into it. People are looking at the wrong metric, but no one's explaining it to them.
Yeah, again, this is the transparency issue. The people within the health department have all of this gamed out. They have a wealth of data at hand to analyze. So we know that professionals are looking at this. They know that if they reach certain thresholds, they're going to have to take certain actions. And that's just what we've tried but failed to get out of the administration is, what are you looking for to make the next certain steps? What combination of factors will it take for you to order schools closed, for example, or institute widespread stay-at-home orders. We can't get that information. So people are in the dark, like, what's it going to take? And so there's just, I think, this general uneasiness among people where, since they don't know, it fuels speculation and anxiety. Because for a lot of us, we have a certain level of kind of PTSD from the spring where our worlds fell apart and we took these huge economic hits, and we don't want that to happen again, but it's this possibility that's just kind of hanging out there. As much as Murphy says he doesn't want to do it, we don't know what it's going to take for him to do it.
Yeah, so. No, I think that's a great point. Kind of combining Len's, comment that we've learned a lot since the spring in March and this and that, when we had lockdowns. And, obviously we've already talked about the economy and what it's done there. And now we're back to a very, increasing trend in terms of what it looks like for the winter. And it seems like the governor straight up changed his stance. I wonder if it's because he feels like he's kind of like locked and tied, because if we do another shutdown, the economy literally, there might not be one left. That's a little dramatic. Or is it that we've learned so much, we've learned enough about protecting who needs to be protected and doing, certain things? I think he's called it surgical approaches, in terms of like closing bars at 10 or whatever time it was that he announced a couple of weeks ago. Do you foresee, you kind of just talked about it, it's a bit of an unknown, but based on your experience in dealing with this, doesn't it seem like he might have changed his approach to how he's handling it? And do you foresee a lockdown, or like what might be the next steps?
I truly think that he wants to avoid a lockdown at all costs, not only because it's going to be bad politically, and I'm not sure if that's at the forefront of his calculus, but it will be bad. Economically, it would be catastrophic, and we don't have the money to help people out. So I do think that he wants to stick with this surgical approach, but I don't know how many more surgeries he can perform to keep it at bay. The next couple of weeks, maybe even the next week or two, considering we just had Thanksgiving, may be the telltale of what's to come. Going back to that decision that he made in June, I think it was, on the restaurants, that was a very unpopular decision. Nobody's quite sure what he was looking at to make that decision, but it was bad image-wise for him, whether or not it was the right decision. And I don't think that he's made those same sorts of moves since, and he has tried his best to keep these certain businesses open, movie theaters, gyms, restaurants, because they haven't been the sources of transmission. So he seems to be doing what he can. And there's been a high level of compliance among people. I think in New Jersey, and even just generally in the Northeast, we've gotten the message, because we went through it in the spring. You can't mess around with this. You gotta wear a mask. Keep away from people. And there's also a lot of people, I think, are just scared and they don't want to go out, and they've kept their circle pretty tight. So all those different factors, I think, have helped out. But if the hospital capacities start being stretched and you have more deaths and transmission goes up, I don't see what other choice Murphy has except to issue a stay-at-home order. The governor of California just did that. And we saw from the spring, California, Washington, they were the first dominoes to fall. And then New York and New Jersey was right behind. So I'm not saying that's the pattern that will happen now, but when you're somebody like me who thinks and is paid to think critically and negative, it's hard not to see that scenario play out if everybody from the governor to Anthony Fauci are saying that we're in for a really long, dark winter.
Yeah, no, let's do a couple more questions and then wrap it up. I had one more on kind of the, you know, not the data determines dates, but he had at one point during the summer announced a recovery commission. I think there was two kind of reopening and recovery committees and commissions, and it was this big kind of panel, and all these folks from Princeton and Ben Bernanke, the old Federal Reserve chairman, is on it. And
hey, careful with the word old.
Old meaning he was present. He was
okay.
A very young looking guy, sharp looking. That's what I was referring to, though. He was a great, actually, Federal Reserve chairman. But anyways, these people, you know, this brain trust was supposed to help, you know, advise him on the reopening recovery. And then on top of that, you had local folks on the ground, political people, and they were like, we're already talking to our businesses. We know what it takes. What you don't need to have this star-studded panel. So my question to you is, like, have you heard, do they provide minutes from these meetings with the recovery and restart commissions? Have we heard anything, any reporting back from that? And did you kind of get the same feeling, or do you think that was more of like a showmanship type of thing? And did you get any pushback from businesses that and political folks that you talked to that they were the people that should be kind of interacting and helping to make these decisions?
Well, you do have some of those smaller, I don't even know if smaller is the right word, but more local associations.
And right.
Those commissions, like the Restaurant Hospitality Association is on one of those panels, I believe. But I mean, I can only speculate because there's been no transparency around that either. And I've written about this, that, you know, he's formed these commissions and task forces. They're not subject to any of the public records laws. So I have no clue what Ben Bernanke's doing, if he's doing anything. There's no minutes. There's no record of what they're doing. There was one briefing where a couple of the members came out and said how great everything they were doing was, but we don't know, again, we don't know any of the details, and that's really the critical information that we need to make some sort of determination of whether they're doing a good job or not, or being effective or what. So,
got it.
I just wanted to follow up on that, Ryan, if I could. And that is, Dustin, have you heard anything from the governor or the governor's office about when the vaccine comes out, distribution and the logistics of that? Because I haven't heard anything.
I think that's a little bit of a moving target now that we're getting more information on the vaccine. Just broadly, the plan, as far as I know, is to vaccinate the healthcare workers first. But that's even tricky too, because then we're only expected to get 130,000 in that first round, and you have 600,000 and some odd healthcare workers. So how do you pick and choose who should get it? And then the CDC last week had a panel that said long-term care facilities should get it first. And the state, as far as I know, has not updated the plan to align with that. So I'm told that there's going to be more information on that coming in the next week or so. So we should be able to get some more clarity on that. But still, the state is going to be in another tough spot where they're going to have to decide who is worth the vaccine and who is not right now. And that's never going to be an easy decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's going to kind of, it reminds me of when we had a shortage, right? You know, going back to the PTSD of when it came here, and we had a shortage of tests, right? So like a test was like gold. People that had the virus weren't able to get tested. And that was the rage of all the news. You know, it's like, you know, so-and-so has been trying to get tested for X amount of weeks. And then you were writing stories about how I think it was the chief of staff maybe ordered, I think it was the health department, whoever, to give tests to his family. So it'll be interesting to see when we do get the vaccine, how that's managed and how that's regulated and then transparency around that, because again, it'll fall under the governor and his team.
Right.
I have heard that we've received, Len, they're starting to distribute some of the vaccines, even though it's not legally authorized.
They've positioned them in New Jersey already.
So they just have to say go for a certain portion. I don't know the size of them. And obviously some of them, not trying to be a doctor here, but one of the, I think it's the Pfizer one, has to be kept at like some very, very cold temperature. So
you're minus 94.
Yeah, something like that. So those are getting out. So a lot of
those... stock and dry ice companies.
There you go. I think that was a great discussion. I appreciate it, Dustin. I know there's a lot of unknown questions. We're like interviewing you as if you're the governor because you're covering him. So apologies.
And your two-year-old didn't scream.
No, which makes me a little bit worried about what's going on.
We'll let you get back to it. And maybe we just go around one more time. But before we do that, I just wanted to thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And we've talked a little bit, and this is a educational program for the state. And Senator Weinberg's episode is coming next. So two great guests in a row, and we really appreciate having coming on and talking to us about what you've seen up close with following the governor and his administration. So thank you.
Yeah, listen, I would just add that, you know, I don't watch every briefing, but early on I did. And, you know, when I got to know who you were and that you were kind of, it was great to see somebody pressing him, please keep it up. There are lots of people out there. We don't reach out. We don't say thank you, but it means a lot to us because we don't feel like our voices are being heard. So thank you for doing your job and doing it so well. Go Navy.
Yep, and I would add that it's been an honor to speak with you, and you know, really admire what you're doing in Trenton, and keep asking the hard questions. You're in the right career, my friend. Stick with it,
Dustin. Maybe a good question for you is what can people do? Joe made a good point out how much of a difference you make. And we talked about the struggling industry in the beginning of the show. What can people do to maybe as you're signing off, to help support the business and help support you via your organization and things like that? And obviously probably becoming a subscriber might be one, but anything else, any other parting words?
If they want to take out a big full page ad, I would...
Follow you on Twitter. What's your handle?
What's that?
They should follow you on Twitter. What's your handle?
It's my first initial and my last name, DRACIOPPI with the at symbol. I think that just considering a subscription would be great. And, you know, whether it's to us or the Star Ledger or the Atlantic City Press, whomever, you know, your local news source, that helps. Even if it's that nice introductory offer of 99 cents for 3 months, you know, every little bit helps. It's really not cheap to do what we're doing and to keep staff. Look at the record. I mean, we have like four people in the state house, which is actually considered a lot. And it's hard to keep that number of people working. And we have really great, talented reporters doing that. So just pony up a couple dollars. That would go a long way. That's our model, is to try to push subscriptions. And I think for the amount of money that it's worth it. I appreciate the kind words that you guys have said, and I won't be too sanctimonious, but I mean, we're really literally here to be the eyes and ears and the voice of the public and small guy. And I don't know anybody else in Trenton who's in it for the most part for any other reason.
I have another idea for you, and that is you've got a great life story, write a book.
I don't know if there's much money in that either.
Oh, you sell a lot of books.
No, on that point though, of that Len saying, if New York Times or someone else calls and tries to take you away to New Jersey, please say no, because we need you here. No, I'm just kidding. You got to do whatever you got to do for your family. But we do appreciate all the great reporting, and definitely here in New Jersey, especially, it's been
absolutely
incredible. Well, it's a lot of fun for me to do. I enjoy it. So I'm happy to be able to have this opportunity. I hope that I'm usually the one asking the questions. I'm not usually on this side of the microphone, so to speak. So I hope I answered sufficiently.
And that's all you're going to say about that.
That's all I'm going to say.
All right. You did great. Keep up the good work. And thank you so much for joining. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Dustin.
All right. Thanks.
Joe, Len, we'll talk to you later.
All right.
Thank
you. All right. Take care,
bye,
guys.
Everyone.
Bye. All right. Bye.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. Talk of the town, Garden State Debate. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate.